So I wanted to continue on with the theme that I talked about at our last meeting, but sort of take a different approach to it. Last time I talked about repetitive patterns, samsara, and our own, the way we do things and undo things. So the reason that I had that kind of experience on the beach that I had was that I was involved in this project that has been rattling some unusual stuff for me, which is the deck, porch, and landscaping project that's going on back here. It was because of some things that I've been seeing and thinking about that I sort of was looking at what was happening with this girl in the way that I did. I mean, there was a reason for my having that experience, which was the frame of mind that I was in. And the frame of mind that I was in was stimulated by what I saw myself doing in relationship to this project. And the reason I could see the frame of mind I was in and what I was doing in relationship to this project was because of the way I was doing the meditation practice. So that's sort of where I want to begin and then get to this other thing. So what we've been doing here is we've been doing this meditative practice on images. So this is not new news. I'm going to come back to this as the place of starting. Something I said quite some time ago that I want to come back to also is the Buddhist idea that every day we go through a cycle of waking, dreaming, deep sleep. We go through those three states of consciousness every day. And we tend to think of them as being separate from each other. But the Buddhist view is that all three are always going on at the same time. We're not necessarily aware of it. That we're always in the frame of mind, which is the dreaming frame of mind, even when we're in the rational frame of mind. But we don't notice what's happening in the dreaming frame of mind. And we're perfectly capable, if we train ourselves, of being in the dreaming frame of mind with abstract rationality and self-consciousness. So this is the meditation practice that Tarab Tulku was talking about in that article, how to develop that level of practice. Similarly, it's quite possible to get into that absolute unitive state of dreamless sleep, which is there with us all the time. But we don't know how to do it. We don't know how to be self-conscious. We don't know how to be aware in any way at all when we're in that particular state. But it's possible to train oneself to get there, according to Buddhist theory. I'm not saying because I've experienced it. I certainly haven't. But that's what the theory is. But what is the case is that when you practice long enough with the images like Vajrasattva or Shakyamuni, the way in which you're practicing with Shakyamuni or anything like that, what you're doing is you're training yourself with self-conscious analytic awareness to slide into the dream state of mind. Because when you're holding these images and working with these images consciously, intentionally, you're bringing those two kinds of mind together. And when you do that, and you do that with focus and stability, you start seeing things differently. And in particular, what you start seeing differently is all the daily stuff that goes on that you ordinarily see either from a dreaming perspective or an analytic rational perspective. You start seeing that in snatches in ways in which you have a different view because you have the view of dreaming in regards to rationality and rationality in regards to dreaming while you're awake. And that's not a difficult achievement. I mean, it takes a few years, but you can get to the place where it begins to happen. So this is what was happening to me when I was meditating. I was thinking about this obsessive odd thing that's going on with this deck project of mine, and this patio project, because I get up in the morning and I do a short meditation and my mind would be full of all this stuff, and then I'd go out and I'd be measuring things and thinking about things instead of doing my meditation practice or getting a good night's sleep. I was really totally obsessive about it. And so I was noticing, what's going on that's making me so obsessive about this? And what I recognized was there was a certain pattern of my own behavior. And that's why I was sensitized to the pattern of the little blonde girl's behavior on the beach, because I'd been looking at these kinds of repetitive patterns. So anybody can do this when their practice becomes a little bit more mature. It's not a big achievement. And that's one of the main points of what I wanted to bring to this conversation. Now, last week I talked about the specific patterning of the way we repeat behaviors which are wholesome or unwholesome in relationship to each other or ourselves. We talked about that as sort of a here and now process. But what I wanted to talk about tonight was that I wanted to talk about it from a bigger perspective. And one of the reasons I wanted to do this is because tonight's potluck was in your honor. And your life is about to go through a big change. So I was thinking about that and thinking about this patterning process. But, you know, I don't understand that what that means for you. I only can understand what that sort of thing might mean for me. So, by way of sharing something that perhaps you would find useful, I'll share my experience as a way of, as an example. Because I can't share your experience. I can't give you your experience, you know, as a way of talking about this. I can only give you mine. So, what I realized in regards to the deck, and this actually gets to the conversation that we started at the dining room table, and I said I didn't want to go there, because then I wouldn't be able to have that conversation now, because I would have done it then. I wouldn't be able to repeat it. What I realized when I was sitting out on the deck one day, and I was sort of looking out at things, and looking kind of, you know, at the space around me and whatnot, and thinking about... Oh, I really want some bamboo here, and don't I need some trees there, and so on and so forth. I realized that Chinese, because this is what came up for me, that Chinese sat in pavilions, which was the word that Kay used. Chinese sat in covered pavilions, and they looked out in their gardens. And that what I was doing was, I was sitting in a covered pavilion looking out at my garden, and it was rattling something. It was bringing up some pattern from something very archaic, which I would then describe as you could call it a past life kind of resonance, if you will. So what I've been thinking about is that for myself, I've always felt that I've had lives in China as a bureaucrat, as an administrator. And since you may know this, Mary, but I don't think anybody else knows this about sort of the Chinese pattern of governance for the last 2,200 years, at least up until communism, was the Confucian system, which was a system whereby young men studied the classics, the Confucian classics of literature and music and the arts and whatnot, and then they sat for an examination. And depending upon how you did in the imperial bureaucratic examination, you got ranked, and on that basis you got sent out to the provinces as an official. And that's where your career began. And then you worked your way through the bureaucracy over some period of time. And this process of examination, strict examination on the classics and ranking people, by their proficiency in handwriting and understanding the classics, by ranking people, then they were awarded posts in certain places. And they had careers that began in those places and moved forward. And a very typical career would be for a young man to study, take the imperial examination, and only, of course, a few people came out at the top and would stay in the capital. And most people, most guys, would rank someplace else, and they'd be sent out to the provinces to some minor post, and that's where they would start their career. And if they did well, they would move forward and they might get to one of the main regional capitals, and then they would have a career in the regional capital. And then at a certain point, most of them would retire. And in many cases, they would retire and they'd go back out to the provinces. They might stay in a regional capital, but they might go out to the mountains and live their lives out in retirement. Sometimes, they could go to the capital and that would be a big deal, and there'd be political uproar or whatever, and they get banished, or they would retire and they go out to the mountains. And they get called back at the very end of their life. They get called back to the capital or to one of the regional capitals because they had some skills that were recognized and they'd be given an important post, and that might be the way they'd end their lives. So this is a very kind of standard story, century after century after century in China. This is what you did if you had scholarly or governmental aspirations. Some people went into business, but there were not a lot of business people. And, you know, 98% of the population were peasants, and then there were a few monks and priests hanging around. But that was pretty much the way the society functioned century after century. So, sitting on my pavilion, I was remembering this process, and I looked at my own life, and so this gets to... And I looked at my own life, and so most of you don't actually know my life, so pardon me for sharing it with you, but it informs this process. Because that process is actually what my life looks like, is what I've been realizing recently, which is that as a young man, I studied and got a PhD, so that's not exactly taking the imperial exams, but you know, it's that sort of thing. And then I started my professional life in small colleges and little towns in the middle of no place. That's like being out in the provinces. And then at a certain point, I moved to San Francisco, which is like, you know, the regional capital. And I had a certain kind of career in San Francisco, which is actually very high profile. Kay knows this when she met me. In a certain realm of intellectual life in the Bay Area, I held an important kind of a position, and I was well connected. I was always asked to be on boards, and, involved in various kinds of salons, and talk with people in conversations that had impacts and had changes and so on and so forth. And that was sort of like 15 years that went on in one way or another, with some breaks in the process, like living in monasteries for a couple of years. But, you know, Chinese bureaucrats would do that too. They would be between positions and they'd take off and they'd live in a monastery for a while if that's what their thing was. And then at a certain point it was time to stop doing that, and then Kay and I moved to the mountains, where basically I went into semi-retirement, which is what my situation is here. I'm living in the mountains, essentially away from the regional capitals, in the equivalent of Confucian semi-retirement. The other thing that's similar is that in order to advance in the Confucian bureaucracy, you had to know the Confucian classics. It didn't matter if you were a Buddhist or a Taoist, you had to know the Confucian classics. So similarly, I've had to make my way through a university system that's based upon principles that I completely don't believe in any way whatsoever. And I think I mentioned at one point I had a job interview at a nearby college. I had the audacity to say that I thought the real education was a subversive activity, and that was the end of that. You know, they didn't want to hear that kind of stuff. But that's what I believe. I don't believe real education is like, you know, stuffing pseudo-information to people's heads and so on and so forth. So I see, sitting in my pavilion, contemplating the rock garden I'm about to build, that my life, this life, is following the exact same pattern of all these ancient Confucian bureaucrats. And does that mean that I used to be a Confucian bureaucrat? It might. I don't exactly know what it means, but what it means to me is that here is a macro pattern which I see repeating itself, either because it's a story that makes sense to me, or because it is a large pattern that's repeating itself, and that in some way I'm living a life whose, what's the word that I want to find here? Whose structure or whose texture is a similar pattern to some other lives. Just as the little girl on the beach was creating the little sandcastles with joy and vigor, and then kablooey, was destroying them over and over and over again, and in that way I could see a repetition of what one does in the small way in one's life. So here I'm talking about a larger pattern. And it's true, I think, that in a certain way, because we get older, we can see these patterns in our lives that we couldn't see when we were younger. But a lot of people get older and they don't see any of this stuff. And I think that one of the reasons they get older and they don't see any of this kind of thing is because they're not training their minds in such a way as they can dream their way into conventional daily reality and see things from a whole different kind of perspective. And that this practice that we've been doing gives you that tool, and it gives you a tool to create meaning out of the big patterns, which otherwise may have no meaning whatsoever. So I wanted to share this because your life is about to take a big change, and I don't know what that means, and I don't know if you know what that means, but this group has been in existence for about a year, and with this meeting, we're going to take a break until next fall at some point. You're going to be taking off to Jordan. You've been kind of a stalwart of being involved with us. And so things will shift, and a new pattern will emerge. And what does that mean? I don't know. But anyway, I wanted to share all of that because that's very much what's been on my mind, both with the pavilion and the rock garden and your leaving and the cycle of whatever the cycle is. I think, April, you're seeing some things in your own life in that way. And I think Kay is too. So, boy, I don't know. You are too. So, and Brian, I don't know. Yeah, okay. So, there we all are, you know. And here's this tool for bringing meaning to these changes that otherwise could be meaningless or appear random.
Or obscure.
Or obscure.
Yeah, or appear random.
Yeah, or appear obscure. Mm-hmm.